This episode of The Projection Booth is dedicated to the great actor Rick Dean. I'm taking the reins this week. So let me just say, welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Justin, and with me, as always, is Mike White.
Hello, you can call me Mike Loaf. So why did you take control of the show this week, Justin?
Well, because, you know, I'm just so passionate about the film we're covering this week. It was my pick this week, and I chose Stripteaser from 1995. This is seriously, like, my top 10 of all-time favorite films, I think. It's the greatest B-movie of all time, in my opinion. And if anyone says anything different, I could be liable to injure them. As for everyone out there listening, we're a little audio heavy today. We have got a few clips and a little couple interviews. And so if we run over in time today, I apologize.
It's fine. So let's get on to the film. I'll say right now that the cool thing about this movie is just how low-key it is. I mean, it came out in 1995 under Roger Corman's New Concord Pictures, and I don't really know a whole lot of people that have seen this movie.
Yes, that is correct. It came out in 1995. It was directed by this fella named Dan Golden. Now, Dan started out his career as a still photographer and screenwriter. He worked on Rusty Cundiff's Fear of a Black Cat. And then he did stuff with Fred Olen Ray, like Wizard of Demon Sword and Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers. So around 1989-1990, he writes a screenplay with his friend named Robert Dodson, and who's a comic book artist. And they base it on True Life Los Angeles Murder. And that turns out to be his first film, which is still unreleased. That's called Naked Obsession. You know, Roger Corman owns that one as well, but I digress. I'm getting ahead of everything a little bit. You know, why don't you summarize the film, Mike, for the people out there listening who probably haven't seen it, you know, except Rich Osman, because I know he's seen it, and our love of this movie is what makes us cinematic soul brothers. So I pump my fist in Black Power to you, Rich.
So you said that Naked Obsession is not released. Do you actually mean it's not released on DVD?
Don't correct me. This is my show. I will choke you. No, yes, you're right. It is not released on DVD. It is on VHS, and it comes under a high cost if you want to own it. I believe on Amazon it's like $60 to own the VHS of it. It's not on DVD, which is strikingly odd because Corman is all about making money. And so why would he not put out a film like Naked Obsession when people are paying $40 to $60 a copy of it on VHS? It makes no sense to me. Instead, we get, you know, the Great Dynamite, Texas Dynamite Massacre instead.
I smell a cover-up. That's what I think is going on. So yeah, by all accounts, Rich Osman should be here with us to talk about this movie. He's actually the one that introduced me to it a few years ago, telling me about it, but he couldn't convince me to see it. And it finally took you strong-arming me to finally sit down and watch this movie. And I'm grateful that you did. It's really great. It's kind of, it feels a lot like a play, and it was written by Dwayne Whittaker and directed by Dan Golden, as you said. And it stars Maria Ford as this stripper, Christina Loren, and she's working at Zipper's Clown Palace, which is one of the best names for a joint in a movie that I can possibly think of. Though we never see Zipper in the whole movie. I kept waiting for Zipper to come out and be like, you know, have the black mask with the zipper across it or something. So she's working at Zipper's Clown Palace. It starts off with her, starts off with a pretty amazing striptease by her. And as the evening goes on, the bar is closing down, and this blind guy comes into the bar. Kind of sounds like the beginning of a joke, but it's definitely no joke when Rick Dean, as the blind guy, shows up. And I don't know how far you want to go into the plot of this movie. I'll just say that eventually some things happen, and Rick Dean takes over the bar, holds everyone at gunpoint, and then it kind of becomes his little power trip as we go along throughout the rest of the film.
Well, let me just rectify a couple of your points. One, Maria Ford is just a little bit more than striptease. We're talking full-on, full female frontal nudity. And Dwayne Whittaker, actually, the name may sound familiar to some people, but they may not be able to put a name with a face. And Dwayne is an actor who's worked in the Corman stable on and off for a while, and he's also an amazing playwright and screenwriter. You know, he did a film back in, I think, 1991 that was directed by Jeff Burr, who Jeff Burr was the gentleman who directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, but I think that was called Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. And, the film that Dwayne and Jeff did together is called Eddie Presley, and we'll be calling that up from the minor leagues in a few weeks, and I know it has a cameo in it from Mike's good friend Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, that's going to be great. I can't wait for you to expose me to another fine entry in Mr. Tarantino's acting career. So that'll be great. So yeah, also on that note, Dwayne was in Pulp Fiction. That's probably where he's best known from. He was Maynard, one of the pawn shop owners, he and Peter Green. And he's the guy who has to go wake up the gimp.
Right. You know, I interviewed Dwayne last year for Mondo Video, and I did manage to ask him, because I like to ask occasional off-the-wall question. So I did ask him in tune if he could tell me what a gimp was. And he actually said, I don't know. And I still don't know what a gimp is. Also, Dwayne has written the screenplays for From Dusk Till Dawn, Part 2 and 3. And I think which actually he did with Scott Spiegel, who is a Sam Raimi connection there. And I think Scott wrote Evil Dead 2. With Sam, I believe. And then he did Eddie Presley, and then he wrote Stripteaser and took it to Corman and Dan Golden to make, because he knew it was kind of like a no-brainer. So, but let me just go back, because I just can't get it out of my head, the fact that you trashed Quentin Tarantino's acting career. And I just want to tell you that Destiny Turns on the Radio is an amazing movie.
I actually paid to see Destiny Turns on the Radio in the theater. I paid to see a movie starring Jim Belushi, which is a crime in and of itself. And then to see Tarantino show up there with his famous "Surf's Up" line. It's just, oh my God.
Well, listen, though, he's done some fine acting roles, and he's really great in Eddie Presley. I think he's a mental patient, if memory serves. I haven't seen it in a while, but yeah, but you know, maybe we can get him for the show. Dwayne Whittaker,
yeah, sure.
Tarantino, you know, I mean, you wanted me to reach out to Bob Rafelson for the Monkees, and Rafelson's up in a mountain, like the Unabomber somewhere.
Well, you got his home phone number now, so I should just give Tarantino a call and be like, hey, this is your good buddy, Mike White. Let's do a show together. Come on.
That's right. I think you should do it, seriously.
So this wasn't the first time that Dwayne had worked with Dan Golden, right?
Yep. So, you know, Dwayne was in Dan's previous film stripteaser called Saturday Night Special. Saturday Night Special is a film about a gentleman named Billy Burnett, the actor who's a musician. He's played the Fleetwood Mac. And he is a rock and roller coming to town in this little nowhere town. There's a bar, and the bar is owned by husband and wife team Rick Dean and Maria Ford. And he falls in love with Maria Ford. She's like a femme fatale, so she seduces him to kill the husband, you know, and get the money, get the bar. It's a typical, you know, film noir story. So, yeah, you know, so Dwayne is the guy they hired to kill Rick Dean in Saturday Night Special. But then, you know, we get to Stripteaser, and I guess the second time the four of them had worked together, Dwayne Whittaker included. And I guess I'll let everyone know that, you know, since we've talked about Eddie Presley earlier, that we'll actually be talking to Dwayne in a few weeks about Eddie Presley for that show.
And hopefully I'll be able to drill him on Quentin's acting career, so we can see how he was to work with as an actor. So yeah, I think it's really cool that with all these Dan Golden films, or at least these early ones, that, you know, you've got Saturday Night Special with Rick Dean and Maria Ford and Stripteaser, and then on top of that, they were also in Naked Obsession as well. You had this whole little troupe of actors, which was pretty great.
Right, so you have this basically, you have a repeat. You have Naked Obsession, Saturday Special, and Stripteaser. And before I go farther, let me just say, in case you haven't seen Naked Obsession, Naked Obsession is amazing. like we talked about earlier, it's unreleased. It's basically it's got William Cat from the greatest American hero in it, Rick Dean and Maria Ford, and Cat is like a city councilman who's going to investigate some property that they want to convert from a strip club into something else for the city, and he just gets into this intrigue of the strip club, and he becomes interested in Maria Ford's character, and she's into asphyxiation sexually, and Rick Dean is this amazing, like, he's really tall in the movie. He's taller than William Cat. It looks like he's just this overtowering man. He's like this, almost like the dude in The Big Lebowski. And he wears these army fatigues, and he's a flute. He plays the homeless bum, and he plays the flute. And it's just awesome. He's like the catalyst for, you know, William Cat's character, basically just to pursue things. And he's always like, "Hey man, you gotta go for it." It's awesome. It's awesome. His name is Sam Silver in the movie, but I digress. So, you know, in a few minutes, we're going to play back our interview we did with Dan Golden a few weeks ago. But before we do that, actually, I wanted to play this clip of Joe Bob Briggs talking about Stripteaser.
Right, yeah. So a few weeks back, Justin and I went to Indianapolis for the Horror Hound Convention in support of my book, Impossibly Funky, AKA Issues to Cinema Art Collection, available now. And we teamed up with filmmaker Graydon Clark and did some stuff, did a showing of Without Warning, and it was pretty nice. We'll talk more about that in another show. And in the heat of that, well, Justin, go ahead. You tell the story.
First off, it's GraydonClark.com. All right, yeah, so, you know, I've been chatty with Joe Bob for a few years. I'm a huge fan of his, and he's pretty much, you know, one of the main inspirations that I ever started writing, period. So, you know, not a lot of people know this, but if you go to JoeBobBriggs.com and look through the fan pictures there, you'll see a very creepy photo of this weirdo that actually has a picture of Joe Bob Briggs. There's a picture of someone who's got a Joe Bob Briggs tattoo on him, and, well, that's me. So, yeah, he's one of my heroes, and I don't think I would have ever started writing anything had not been for reading his stuff in the newspaper or, like, any of his books. So, basically, I stalk him on occasion, and we exchange emails every now and again, and I talk to his assistant and a partner in crime, Tracy, every now and again as well, and she's really nice. And so, you know, we're going to Horror Hound anyways, and Joe Bob was going to be there. So I decided to hit him up for an interview, you know, with his real person. His real name is John Bloom, and so I printed off his original review of Stripteaser that he wrote for the Dallas Observer back in, I think, July of 1996, and where he compared the film Stripteaser to the Demi Moore, Burt Reynolds movie Striptease. So I guess you can think for yourself on which one is better. So I printed it off, and he agreed to read it on mic as Joe Bob Briggs for our little show here. It turned out really good, and while we were doing it, there was an audience around his table at Horror Hound that were, you know, kind of watching him in action because, you know, he's very sullen and, you know, he's not Joe Bob Briggs in person, you know, but he turns it on like just like a switch, you know, when you meet him. And so, you know, it was really cool, and I hope everyone enjoys it, and because you'll never find anything like it on any other podcast.
For sure.
I'm Joe Bob Briggs with the review you've all been waiting for, the one in which I compare Striptease, estimated budget $40 million, to Stripteaser, estimated budget $40. Guess which one's better? You already know, don't you? Striptease stars Demi Moore, who received $12.5 million for her performance and spends about one full minute naked. Stripteaser stars Maria Ford, who received $20,000 for her performance and spends about 10 full minutes naked. The other strippers in Striptease are some very mediocre-looking babes. This is the best they could do. I can't believe it. The other strippers in Stripteaser are hot. Demi Moore cannot dance. She does those dramatic spin on your heel, dangle off the pole dealies, but she never really gets into it. She looks like a gal who's watching herself dance. Maria Ford, on the other hand, gets nasty. The lady knows what high heels were made for. The supporting star in Striptease is Burt Reynolds, who's so cartoony as the horny U.S. congressman that you start to feel icky every time he comes on the screen. The supporting star in Stripteaser is Rick Dean, who plays a creepy, brain-damaged, suicidal, gun-toting pervert psycho like he really needs to be a maniac. Somebody please give him the $12.5 million. And another thing about Striptease, let me get this plot straight. Demi Moore gets fired from her job as a secretary at the FBI loses custody of her daughter to a major sleazeball thief redneck and decides her only choice in life is to dance naked for a living until she can kidnap the kid and then get a series of high-paid private dance jobs for creeps until she can give the kid the healthy, nurturing home life she deserves because not having her around is like my heart is missing. And to me, uses her own kid in the movie. Like her real-life kid. Can we spell therapy? All right, now the plot of Strip Teaser, on the other hand, is that a psycho creep pretending to be a blind man comes into a strip club at closing time one night, holds everybody hostage, and proceeds to strip away their delusions while telling his life story while forcing everybody to do incredibly degrading things for his twisted amusement. Now that is a plot. Okay, let's see how they match up. Drive-in totals, dead bodies, Strip Tease 2, Strip Teaser 10, Naked Breasts, Strip Tease 26, Strip Teaser 18, which is a little misleading since some of those Strip Tease boobies are half-second exposures. Aardvarkin, Strip Tease Nada, Strip Teaser Yes, Drooling Panting Bar Patrons, Strip Tease 40 Jillion, Strip Teaser 1. Have these people never been inside a topless bar? Nobody really drools in a topless bar. Beating, Strip Tease 4, Strip Teaser 3, Cockroach Eating, Strip Tease 1, Strip Teaser Nada, Lint Sniffing with Vaseline, Don't Ask, Strip Tease 1, Shame on You, Bert, Nails Through the Hands, Strip Tease Nada, and Strip Teaser 1, Actual Topless Routine, Strip Tease 4, including Demi dancing while brushing her teeth a la Flashdance, Strip Teaser 5. Dancers Who Work with Snakes, Strip Tease 1, Strip Teaser 0. Don't you just hate that? That's a bad stat. Dialogue, They're Filth, Exploiters of the Poor. That's from Strip Tease. Whereas in Strip Teaser, you have lines like, give me the names of the guys right now or I'm going to take a blowtorch to your elbow. Drive-In Academy Award nomination only one for Rick Dean as the psycho in Strip Teaser who says, I'm directing this piece. You can direct the Pinter play next semester. Strip Tease, 1 star. Strip Teaser, 4 stars. The choice is yours.
Okay, we're back. I really love the whole bit about giving Rick Dean from Strip Teaser the money that Burt Reynolds was paid to be in Strip Tease. So I was not a big fan of Strip Tease, even though it was great. Every time that someone would rent that at Blockbuster, they'd complain about it being really choppy in one part. And you can imagine which part that was. It was the tape was pretty much worn out from the one kind of boob shot of Demi Moore that happened in that movie.
Yep. So, you know, you mentioned Rick Dean. And immediately, I just want to go off, like, start spouting off about Rick, because I'm a huge fan of his, and I've seen everything he's done. But I guess I'll wait until we play back the interview with Dan before I go into one of my rants about Rick Dean.
Yeah, without further ado, here's the interview that Justin and I did with the director of Strip Teaser, Dan Golden, a few weeks back. And once we're done, we'll be back to talk more about the film. Roll it.
So, Dan, how'd you come across the script for the film?
Strip Teaser was actually a script that my buddy Dwayne Whitaker had written. And I had kind of forgotten about this when I had done some prior interviews on Strip Teaser, but my memory was refreshed somehow along the way recently that Dwayne had actually written it with the intention of Tom Calloway directing it. I don't know if he wrote it with the intention of Tom directing it, but I know that Tom was hip to the script before I was, and that Tom wanted to direct it. Now, Tom is another good friend of mine. He's a renowned cinematographer. He works all the time. I think he's in Bulgaria right now shooting something for HBO. Tom later directed a show called Broke Sky, of which I was one of the producers along with several others, and one of the writers along with several others. And I also AD'd that show, which we shot over the course of a few years and, you know, got great critical reviews. And then IFC picked it up. It's been on Sundance Channel, but I don't know what's going to happen with it from here on out. But anyway, at the time, and that was basically Tom's directorial debut, The Broke Sky. But he wanted it to be Strip Teaser. What wasn't called Strip Teaser at the time was called Zipper's Clown Palace. And Tom had actually intended to direct that show. He just couldn't get it off the ground. So when I got wind of that, or I don't know if Dwayne approached me next or I got wind of it somehow, I don't exactly recall, but I thought, well, let me run it by Roger and see if we can get it going there. And we did. And it was no problem whatsoever. He bit right away and we made the show. And I had completely forgotten in the last few years that Tom at one point had intended to direct that. So that's how I became aware of it. It was a script that Dwayne had and Tom wasn't able to get it launched anywhere. And Dwayne approached me, and I'm glad he did.
How did you and Dwayne Whitaker originally meet?
I knew Dwayne from way back hanging out at a local bar in Los Angeles called Bordner's. And I used to hang out there quite frequently with friends like, Jeff Burr, director friend of mine, Courtney Joyner, a writer, director friend of mine. And these guys knew Dwayne. And we used to just sit in there and drink all the time. And that's basically how I got to know him, just from hanging out at this one local watering hole in Hollywood. And, I was pretty impressed with, a lot of things about him. Of course, that he's an actor and he's a screenwriter, but he's also a voracious reader of novels. And he turned me on to some cool books and things. So, when I was casting Saturday Night Special, I thought of him for a part because I knew he had done a lot of. I think when I first knew him, he hadn't done the Pulp Fiction gig yet, but he had done some episodic television and he had done some things, I think, for Jeff Burr. And, so I was familiar with his work. And when we were casting Saturday Night Special, probably by that time he had already done Pulp Fiction. I'd have to look up the years on all this stuff to make sure. But I know when I first knew Dwayne, he hadn't done Pulp Fiction yet. But so by the time Saturday Night Special came around, I thought he would make he would be good for this one part. And sure enough, he was.
Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with Rick Dean and Maria Ford? How did you guys come about as kind of a team?
Well, they both came to me through, Roger's company. The very first, and they were both in the very first film I did, which was for Roger, the thing called Naked Obsession. Maria, I think, was pretty much a done deal in terms of Roger's mind. I mean, that's who he wanted to put in the movie. And I recall that I did read some other girls, but I don't remember if I read them for that part or not. I think Roger was pretty well set on using Maria, and I didn't have a problem with that. So ultimately, that's what I did. Rick, likewise, was strongly, strongly recommended my producer over there at the time, which was a fellow named Rodman Flender. And he recommended Rick and Maria, too. I mean, the next film he did was Saturday Night Special, so I brought them both back for that. And then I think we did a film in between there without Rick, but Maria and I went to Russia and did a movie. And then upon returning from that, we did Strip Teaser, if memory serves. And once again, I thought Rick would be perfect. In fact, Dwayne had written the script with Rick in mind. I mean, he told me that. I recall that much. So, I mean, he was perfect for it. And Maria was just a shoe-in because, well, we got Rick and we got a strip joint. Got to get Maria in there. So that was pretty much how that all worked out.
So going back to the structure of the film and, even the script, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the film comes across as sort of a stage play.
Right. Well, that was just a device by which we could keep the budget down because basically the less locations involved in a film, the less expense. You don't have to make any company moves. You don't have to waste time traveling somewhere. I mean, if you can just do the bulk of the film in one location, you can get a lot more done in a lot shorter period of time. And so that's the way it was designed with the, the strip joint being basically, the main milieu. This is where most of it's going to happen as if it were a stage play. But then to make it a little more cinematic, we opened it up a bit. I mean, in the writing of it, Dwayne opened it up a bit with cross-cutting with the cops and stuff like that. Just a device to save money, to do a picture which, had a minimum amount of locations and took place primarily in one location and was by and large talking heads, which usually is the kiss of death, and Roger doesn't usually go for it all. But I guess there was enough nudity in there for him and everything, enough other things going on that he was happy to fund the picture.
So shooting the film so quickly and, on hardly any money, what do you see as some of the advantages of working like that? And also, what are some of the disadvantages to working like that?
Well, the only real advantage to it was so little of Roger's money that he didn't bother to, I mean, he just kind of let us do what we wanted. He wasn't extremely hands-on about it. It was such a little, so little was at risk for him that we were almost under the radar. I think it's the only show I've ever worked on for Roger where he didn't pay a visit to the set. Typically, he will show up at least one time to see what's going on, but I don't recall seeing him show up once. So, I mean, that was kind of the advantage in that we really could pretty much do what we wanted. I mean, we never got any dictates from the front office about anything other than, in pre-production, there were a couple of notes from Roger about adding some nudity, which is fine. And then, of course, in post, he always does his final edit on things. But during the course of shooting, I mean, he pretty much left us alone. So that's the advantage of it. Disadvantages are many. I mean, you know, it's always better to have money, you know, to throw at any problems that arise. You know, the lack of money just means you have to be more creative with what you have, which I guess you could say is maybe some sort of veiled advantage. Maybe that's an advantage that I'm overlooking. All the shows I work on are pretty much low budget. So I've never really had the luxury of having a lot of money to do any movie. So I almost can't compare the two because I don't know what the other experience would be like. Although I suspect, and I have heard and read and things on like a big studio picture or something. I mean, you constantly have the dictates of the front office being handed down to you. And I can only think that would be a real pain and not a fun way to make a movie.
So the thing I liked about the movie was, you know, the level of realism in it. You know, the cop that has the pimple on his head, you can't take your eyes off of it. And there's this, like, sweaty feeling you get watching the movie, you know, because it's just so claustrophobic throughout. And Rick Dean's just, like, you know, sweat's pouring off of this guy. You know, was that all intentional?
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely just, you know, I'm not going to go so far as to say that I applied that zit to the man's head, but I mean, I certainly noticed it, but I'm like, all right, so what? You know, I didn't make any attempt to conceal it or anything. And the sweat, yeah, that was, I can't remember if we did any spritzing on Rick for sweat in that movie or not, but I do know that he was sweating on his own. And when he would, it's like, hey, just leave it because, I mean, it looks good. That's pretty much what you want. So, and I kind of went for that. I was kind of going for that same sweaty feel, in Saturday Night Special as well. If I recall, at the screening of that I had at Raleigh Studios, I actually got some comments that I think the air conditioning was off that day in the studio, in the theater or something. Somebody made the comment to me that they thought that was something, you know, like some Bill Castle gimmick or something, that I had intentionally turned off the air conditioning so that they could feel the heat and sweat like the characters were, which I did not. It was not, the air conditioning just wasn't working. But anyway, that sweaty thing I've gone for a couple of times.
You and I have talked about it before, Dan, but, you know, Rick Dean is such an incredible actor. The performance he gives is just amazing. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how special he was.
Well, Rick had his delivery and his take on dialogue is unlike anyone else's that I've ever heard. He just has a very quirky sort of delivery, and the cadence of his speech is very, very unique to his, you know, to Rick Dean. And I think very effective, particularly when he's playing these kind of whacked out characters. You know, they shouldn't just look and sound like everybody else, you know, and you could write a line of dialogue and, you know, you could just say it conventionally. I mean, it could be a totally benign line of dialogue, like, hey, how's the weather? Or nice weather we're having, isn't it? You know, and one guy could say it and it's just as benign as it was written. But Rick could say that line and suddenly it has menace. It has edge. It has something, all of a sudden it seems to have these layers. And what I found myself doing, and this is true to this day, even though Rick is no longer with us, I mean, I will at times like be writing dialogue thinking, you know, hearing Rick saying it, you know, I mean, it actually helps me as a writer, unfortunately he's not going to be saying these lines that I'm writing, but, it's kind of a muse for me to actually kind of hear it's for certain characters that I write to actually hear how Rick might do them. It's been a real inspiration. And the other thing too is, again, given his size, you would think, you know, you look at him, you might think, okay, tough guy, and you would expect some tough guy delivery, but no, I mean, there's, there's a whole nuance to what he does that it's just, you know, it's creepy. I mean, and it would be creepy, you know, if he were a smaller guy. It doesn't matter, you know. But you would, when I first saw, the very first thing I saw of him was some Vietnam movie he did where he was playing a biker or something. And I guess that's why I was so resistant. It's because, well, this is, but the part of Sam Silver is not like some tough biker guy. But, you know, Rick was an actor. I mean, it doesn't matter what, I mean, you know, acting is not about how you look. It's about what, you know, the feeling you instill in the audience when you deliver the dialogue or when you just react without dialogue, whatever you're doing, you know, in terms of your performance, it's the way you, it's the feeling you create within the audience more so than just having the right wardrobe and looking like you're that character, you know? So, I mean, that's what he was able, you know, he was able to just bring, you know, to make any character seem interesting, you know? I mean, I've seen some of the episodic television that he's done, and you know, I mean, you know, a lot of the writing is just you know pretty pedestrian. It's just like some sitcom. He did some sitcoms. He did some different things, but you know, he was always interesting to watch because he always would have some bizarre take on the line, and he would phrase things in a certain way that would just create more interest than just the line alone on the page. So I don't know. I don't really know how else to put it into words. He had something. He had a charisma about him, I think, that kind of jumped off the screen. I mean, he was certainly, you know, he wasn't a leading man type or anything like that. But he should have worked a lot. He should have worked in A pictures. He should have worked a lot more than he did. And he really, you know, he deserved to be a movie star.
Yo, you know what a misogynist is?
Somebody who hates women.
You're not as dumb as you look, yo.
Is it okay if I get my cigarettes?
Where are they?
In my purse over there.
No.
But I smoke menthol.
Smoke one of these or nothing.
That's okay. I'll just go without.
What a fucking brat.
I want my cigarettes, Nurse Ratchet. I want my cigarette.
Right, and on that note, isn't it fair to say that, you know, the film is sort of an underrated or undiscovered gem? You know, why didn't Rick ever translate into a big A-list film star?
Yeah, I think Rick was a bit of an undiscovered talent. Although he may have shot himself in the foot in many instances, you know, he could be a handful, you know, in terms of, I remember one day he was late on Saturday Night Special. He was like way late and we're shooting all this stuff around him. And, you know, it wasn't very much fun. And, you know, of course you do that on a studio picture or something, you're out the door. I mean, they don't put up with that. So, I don't know, you know, he may have pissed off a casting director or two along the way or something. I don't know for certain, but, you know, just being the bizarre character that he was in real life. And I've, you know, hung out with him quite a bit when we weren't working, you know, he's a pretty wild guy. I mean, I could see that, you know, he probably wouldn't fit in very well with, you know, in terms of toeing the line to do what he needed to do to have an A-list career. You know, it would have just been too much work for him. I mean, if he can just go and he can do some low budget movies and you know, have enough to eat and drink, with an emphasis on drink. And which is not to say that he didn't take acting seriously. He certainly did. I mean, he studied that craft and he taught that craft. He had this, towards the end of his life, he had this studio that he actually took in acting students. And he had the, I forget what it was called, but I mean, it was Rick's own thing that he did on his own. And, gave acting lessons and stuff. And I mean, he's very committed to the craft, but you know, I don't think he would have, you know, I don't think he would have ever been able to meet the confines of a weekly series or something, for example, you know. But it's not, but the talent was there. The talent was there. The commitment was there, you know, the commitment to the art, but the commitment to the business is a different thing. That's probably where he fell short. You know, I don't think he took it seriously enough as a business, you know, to make that A-list and to do all this big time stuff. But he certainly took it serious as an art. I think that, you know, with a slightly different mindset, I'm sure he could have had a fantastic career, but that wasn't Rick. You know, Rick was kind of a fly by the seat of the pants guy, you know, and you couldn't regiment Rick in the way that would be necessary, I think, for an A-list career.
You guys and gals might or might not be aware of this. I know I was damn sure impressed. Miss Christina has actually done a couple of movies. Bad movies, but what the fuck? Even did a couple little walk-on roles on the tube, didn't you, Miss Christina? Yes, sirree, Bob. A fucking actress in her humble little group. I was something of a thespian myself one time. Nothing professional like yourself, Miss Christina. But we all can't be professional, can we? Yeah, I did a touring production of a melodrama a few years back. Actually, just toured around the parks in this one area. But hey, that counts too. I portrayed the villain. Now, I'm going to share something with you, Miss Christina, that most fellas wouldn't admit to. But by golly, I am not most fellas, am I? I did play around in your underwear drawer and dirty laundry. And yes, I did sniff the crotches of your panties.
You know, last time you and I talked about the film, Dan, you mentioned to me that you thought the film was flawed in some places. I was wondering if you could talk a little, you know, where you think the film is flawed.
Well, I remember while working on it, I thought that the entire second half dragged a lot. But I no longer think that. I mean, I think that was eventually cured, you know, in post and everything, and editing and sound mix and all that. So that turned out a lot better than I ever thought it would. But the flaws are things that I just wasn't there to control in post, because I was able to lock the picture, but I wasn't able to sit in on the sound, you know, sound mix or anything. I was doing another picture for Roger, the one in the Philippines, the terminal virus thing. So there were just things that, if I were there, they would be a little different. Like, I mean, for example, I mean, these are minor things, I suppose, but it mostly has to do with the way the music was laid in. Like, there's a scene, there's a thing with the two cops as they first pull into the parking lot of Zippers, and they're having some dialogue, and there's a music cue going on in there, which was a thing from a cue from Davy Allen and the Arrows, who had a big hit in the 60s. The cue, so I was able to get three cues from Davy Allen and the Arrows, and I can't remember how that came about, but I was jazzed that I was able to do that. Somebody had given me a CD and their card and said, I can get you this music if you want, and I'm like, hell yes. So we made a deal for three songs. And I had specific places in the movie where I wanted to use the songs. But when I returned to the country and watched the movie, watched the mix, some of the things were not in the right places. And one example is that scene I started to describe where the cops enter the parking lot in front of Zippers towards the end of the movie. And they've got that cue going, one of the Davy Allen cues going, as if, to me, it's like, it sounds like the cops are listening to the radio or something. And then that idea in my mind is only augmented when one of them says, turn that thing off. But he's talking about, you know, the ham radio thing. And there's a voice coming over there, turn that thing off. But it's, I always get the impression watching it that he's telling him to turn the radio off because he doesn't like the music or something. You know, I don't know if these things ever bother anybody else, but that song's not supposed to be there. That wasn't where I wanted it. And, there's other things. Anytime you do a movie, I mean, you're always – there's just things that you wish were better. But again, it's been so long. I can't recall – I mean, mostly it had to do with the way that music got laid in. These are just things that if I were in town at the time supervising the mix, that they just would have been different.
Now, when Strip Teaser was released, the film was pretty financially successful for Roger, right?
It did quite well in terms of a DVD release. I don't know the exact numbers, but I mean, I know that it shipped really well.
So do you think, you know, the film was marketed correctly? You know, it's got that horrible cover art. And the same thing with, like, your last film, too. Do you think that was marketed properly? And if you think it was marketed differently, do you think it would have found a bigger audience or a wider audience?
Well, I mean, the campaign for Naked Obsession bothered me a lot more than the campaign for Strip Teaser. I thought that, I mean, I know, I understand your point that you wouldn't, particularly with that, the black cover where Maria is pretty much naked, that, you know, that, I mean, has exploitation written all over it. And there are certainly exploitation elements in the movie. So I would think that, you know, to some extent that represents the movie, but it doesn't, it hardly scratches the surface in terms of what the movie really is. But I don't know that you could ever market it. I mean, I don't really know what the audience for the movie is because, you know, on the one hand, I mean, it is kind of this cool, dark psychological thriller, but then it's got this, you know, I will say even gratuitous nudity in it, which is, you know, something Roger wanted even more than what was originally there. You know, there's more nudity there than is certainly necessary to tell the story. And to that extent, it's gratuitous. But so it's almost like you're almost tainting it for those who might just enjoy a purely kind of psychological thriller, because you've got, it's this weird crossbreed where you've got just this, you know, blatant, you know, kind of sexploitation stuff going on at the same time. So it's just a weird crossbreed. I don't know that it, you know. I mean, I'm glad that there are people that like it. I mean, I'm satisfied with the result, and I'm glad you like it. And obviously, other people have liked the movie. I mean, it did ship pretty well for Roger in terms of his DVD release. You know, better than all, you know, most of his other titles at that time. So, to that extent, you might say he probably did market it right. I don't know. I mean, would it have found a wider audience? You know, if with a different campaign, perhaps, but maybe it was always cursed because, you know, when you get down to it, no matter what, you know, what the core of it is, it still has these sort of exploitation dressings around it, you know, which was what I had to do to get it made. And that might turn off a larger audience. I really don't know.
You know, I look at the film as something outside of just simple sexploitation. I almost look at it, you know, as like a major cinematic and artistic effort. Do you look at the finished product on that level as well?
Oh, I don't think it's, you know, purely sexploitation by any means. And as I said, obviously there would be a certain amount of, you know, sexual content and nudity and things like that. I mean, it's built right into the story. I mean, one of the things that the Rick Dean character does is have one character, you know, blow another character. So, I mean, you know, I mean, it's inherent to the story that there are these sexual elements, but, well, let's put it this way. My intention going, who knows what I would have decided in the midst of it, but what I intended going in was that there would be no full nudity, right? This would be just like a topless bar. So there was not going to be any full nudity. You wouldn't have seen that whole opening credit strip number. Now, those are two things specifically that Roger's people. One of them may have been a request from Mike Elliott. I know the full nudity thing was a request from Roger, and he specifically requested in that gunpoint strip to have her fully naked. So I talked to her, and she said that would be cool. And I'm like, all right, sure, we can do that. So that's one thing that I wouldn't have otherwise had. Not that it bothers me. I think it's fine, and I think she looks very nice fully naked. It doesn't bother me at all. Might be too much for some people is all I'm suggesting. And then the other thing is the whole opening striptease number. with Maria is just, you know, it may have been Mike Elliott, who was another guy over there at the time, who said, it needs another strip number, just put something in the opening credits. This is in pre-production. So, you know, that would not have otherwise existed. You know, I mean, who knows? I might have come up with it on my own, but probably wouldn't have otherwise existed in the absence of somebody, you know, suggesting that to me. So, you know, a power that be suggesting that to me. And I don't know if it gets the film off on the wrong foot with so the first thing they see is a girl stripping. But it's more, you know, as you've discovered, I mean, it's a lot more than just that. But I think it's a film that has some merit. It's a psychological thriller with a certain amount of merit and style that has what some could consider an excess of exploitation.
So did you have any involvement with the film's sequel?
Oh, I didn't have anything to do with that, actually. Dwayne and I wrote a treatment for a sequel at his place one day, which we kind of liked. And again, my memory's so bad. I don't know the timeline here. I don't remember if we did that and showed it to Rob. I don't even know if we got it to Rob. I think maybe we wrote that and then found out that he was already doing the sequel or something like that. I know we missed the boat on it somehow, that we had an idea for a sequel and we actually came up with a little treatment on it. But yeah, you know, that is how it went, now that I think of it, because we came up with the treatment for this thing. Then after we finished it, and we worked on it for like a day, I mean, it wasn't any long period of time, we finished it, and I think, okay, I'll, you know, take this to Roger. And then I found out that he was already in production on a sequel to the movie, a strip teaser. I don't think it's a sequel, although I've never seen it, so I can't be certain. I think it's just, you know, a sequel in name only, Strip Teaser 2. I don't think it has any relation to the first one.
All right, I got to ask. What was the treatment that you guys came up with?
It involved Neil, which is the Rick's character, his brother, trying to avenge Neil's death and tracking down Maria, who covered her bullet hole scar with a nice little butterfly tattoo. That was the opening scene of the movie. She was getting... or the treatment, there is no movie, but she was getting her bullet hole scar, you know, tattooed into a nice butterfly design or something. And she was, I guess, living with Lance, with Lance's character, Lance August, stuttering dude, you know. And then Rick Dean's evil brother, although they're both evil, enters the mix and starts stalking her. So it was something along those lines. And then people were being tortured and killed along the way somehow, and it was all leading to Maria. And it was a whole kind of revenge motif thing.
And Rick Dean would have been the evil twin brother, I hope.
Cheesy as that sounds, that may have been it. I can't remember, but I think it may have been that, which sounds awfully stupid. But it may have been that, because I don't know who else I would have thought to do the part. So he's got a twin brother, you know, I mean, that would have been really stupid. But I can't remember now, because my temptation, of course, would be, well, let's use Rick. But then it would be like, oh, it's his twin brother. Oh, my God. You know, but, you know, I wouldn't put it past me. Maybe that's what we were doing. I can't remember now. I know it was his brother, but I don't remember if we were actually going to have him do the part again or if we were thinking of someone else. Actually, we were thinking of someone else for the Maria part, and I can't remember what that was. But I remembered we were talking about some possible alternatives for her, and I don't remember what that was about. And the Rick part, I don't remember at all now. If I could ever find that treatment, I'd probably have a better idea. He has an evil twin, yeah, but he was evil to begin with. So, well, there are two evil twins. I don't
know. So here we are all these years later talking about the film, a film that, you know, a large population of the world hasn't seen to any extent. So with that being said, do you think that the film is an undiscovered gem?
Well, I wish the film were better known. I'll put it that way. I mean, I don't think it's I don't think it's a very widely known film. And one of the problems with that is that it, to my knowledge, and I would know because I would get some royalties on the music, this thing has never played television anywhere in the world, as far as I know. And that's, you know, and I guess I'd probably just, it's too raw and gritty. But, I mean, you know, if we're playing cable or something, then people would see it. Then it would have a higher profile.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340.
All right, so we're back. Let's get right back into the thick of it. Why did you offer up Stripteaser as this week's pick?
Again, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's amazing. No one's ever seen it, so it's a perfect choice to introduce to people. You know, it's just, it's amazing. Like, it comes across, if you look at it, you look it up on Amazon, it looks like this possibly cheesy bad movie, and the cover art is just got this woman in a dress or some. There's another cover out there. I think she's partially naked on a stripper pole, and it just says Stripteaser. And in the back, there's these weird pictures, and you know the write up doesn't even do it justice. And you watch this movie, and it's almost like a stage play, and it's really this movie about performances. It's got Rick Dean and Maria Ford in it, and these performances are just so epic and so amazing. Like, Joe Bob was right when we played his review. It's really to the point, and I think it really is the greatest. I don't really like the connotation B movie, but I really think if I have to use that connotation, I will say it's the greatest B movie ever, simply because it didn't play theaters and it was a Roger Corman movie, even though his name's not even on it, but it was produced by Roger Corman. Roger Corman put up the money for it. But I truly think it is the greatest B movie of all time, and I can't express enough that everyone should see this movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was very glad that you picked that. It was definitely an eye-opener, and I was glad to have seen it. It's very tight. The screenplay is very, very tight. It takes place in just a couple locations. There's the action going on at Zipper's Clown Palace, and then there's the two cops that are traveling around the city. Definitely not. Well, I like the one guy's line where I'm bad cop and he's bad cop. You know, they're not the good lieutenant, let's say. So it was great to see those guys kind of doing their thing and having their little monologues. And it was really, you could tell that it was written by an actor because there are some really juicy monologues in this film. And I think that everyone who's asked to perform does a great performance with them. One other thing I want to say before we get back into it, too, is that I'm amazed by all the cameos that are in the movie. The people at the strip club, the people on the bus that Rick Dean is on at the beginning of the film. And I wanted to ask Dan Golden about John Lazar because I would love to speak to him someday. He's the guy that played Z-Man Ronnie Barstow in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, who is one of my favorite actors in that film.
Very Shakespearean. Yeah, he doesn't have any lines in Stripteaser, actually. But, and I'll just point out that he did another film that is really fabulous, and no one would ever think twice about watching this movie, and it's called Attack of the 60-Foot Centerfold. And it's Fred Olen Ray movie, and I think and Wynorski's got a great – Jim Wynorski, who, you know, he's done a lot of Roger Corman stuff as well. But he's got a great cameo, Jim, like pointing at the centerfold. He's like, "Look," or something like that. And he's just running down the street. It's so funny. It's just, you know, it's exactly what it is. You would think it is. It's Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, but it's with nudity. And it's awesome. So yeah, John Lazar was in that too. And then there, speaking of cameos, you've got Linnea Quigley in it, as Dan pointed out in the interview. I think she's keeps her clothes on. And then you've got Richard Gibbe in it as well, who is the director of Virgin High, Hot Under the Collar, and he's got an awesome new movie coming out called Insight with Christopher Lloyd. So I guess, you know, I guess it's proper time to talk about Rick Dean. I'm a huge fan of Rick Dean. I've seen every single movie he's ever been in, I think, at this point, and I'm working on a project right now where I'm writing about him. You know, he's done all kinds of work, and he's like, you know, he did these movies for Roger Corman. Like, he did smaller roles, but he did this movie called Nam's Angels. He did Carnosaur 3. He did Black Scorpion with Joan Severance, New Crime City. And also there's a series of films that Roger Corman did called the Blood Fist movies with Don the Dragon Wilson. And he was in part 3 of that, where he's a prison inmate, and he's in it with Don the Dragon Wilson. He's also in it with Richard Roundtree. And it's kind of like, the, in my opinion, the last of the best Blood Fist movies. So he turns a really good performance in there. He was in The Unborn for Roger Corman. Then he did a movie with Paul Bartel called Not Like Us, which I think no one's ever seen but me, and it's so good. He worked with Jim Minorski on his Little Miss Millions, which was the movie that Jim says that he discovered Jennifer Love Hewitt on. Plus, he did episodes of Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. with Bruce Campbell. And then, you know, he's turned in some really memorable performances. You know, he's kind of the actor that you see his face occasionally, and you probably don't know his name, but you remember him. Like, he had a really memorable role in Tales from the Hood, which is another Rusty Cundiff movie as well. So working in twice. He's a prison inmate in that movie, an antagonistic prison inmate, and he's covered in, like, all these Nazi tattoos, and he's just really intense. It's awesome. And so then, you know, you come to the Dan Gold movies, where I think he really shines, because I think more than he does usually, because Dan, I think, sees him as the talent he is as well, you know, which is a very true, very undiscovered talent. So, yeah, I mean, I can't even speak enough about him. His performance is epic in this movie. And I was going to ask you, Mike, in your opinion, do you think, had Rick Dean not been in this movie, do you think this movie would work as well?
It would take an actor of an immense caliber to do the work that Dean did in this film. And he brings so much energy to the role and just so much intensity. And I think that, you know, Dan Golden did do you're right. He recognized the talent that Dean had, and he kind of gave him enough rope to go out there. And he shined, you know, the whole time. I love, you know, because he kind of plays almost two roles in the film, because he comes in and he's playing the blind character, and then we find out that he's not actually blind, and his whole personality just shifts at that point. And I think it's very, you know, the writing is very, very clever. His references to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest throughout the film is great, and having a stutterer in there as one of the characters is pretty terrific too. But yeah, Dean just, I mean, he could have gone too far and just started chewing up the scenery, but he doesn't. You know, I thought that he was pitch perfect in that role.
Right.
I hope that this discussion makes more people go out. I mean, because, yeah, to your point earlier, the cover box art for these movies is I wouldn't say it's atrocious, but it's definitely misleading. And it's not something that you're going to, you know, God, I almost said walk by in the video store, but that's kind of an old thing to say.
But it's very true, and they're extremely misleading. I think they're marketed misleadingly, and also the movie trailers for them are absolutely disgustingly horrible. They're extremely misleading. The trailer for Stripteaser, whoever cut this thing had no cares about the film. They were just trying to make a buck, because the trailer has nothing to do with the movie. In fact, it's got shots in the trailer from Dan's previous movie, Naked Obsession, in the trailer for Stripteaser. So it makes no sense. It's painfully misleading. And it's no wonder that people, you know, no people have seen this. Like, you know, Dan said that the film was successful for Roger, like in the home video market, and that's great. It probably was. But this is the difference there, is it was successful, but the wrong people saw this movie, in the sense that you had, guys that rented movies, you know, single guys coming home from work renting movies that had no interest in film as art, who, yeah, you know, probably rented it because it had a hot chick on the cover. And Rhea Ford is really hot. But the thing is, and, you know, we talked about this earlier, about whether the film would work without Rick Dean. But that's the thing, is Rhea Ford was hugely popular back in the late 80s and early 90s as well in these type of movies. And this is a situation where if Rhea Ford was missing in this movie, it wouldn't matter. Because she doesn't have, I mean, her character is important to the plot, but anyone could play that character. Like, she doesn't stand out like she does in Saturday Night Special, or in Dan's other film, Naked Obsession. She's really pivotal, I think, in that film. So, I mean, I don't think she's significant in this film as much. But maybe I could be wrong. You know, it's Maria Ford, and everyone loves her.
So to your earlier point about would this movie have worked without Rick Dean, it's very funny that right around the same exact time, there was another movie that came out that was very similar to this one, and it was called Headless Body in the Topless Bar. I had the unfortunate pleasure of watching this film when I was doing some research on Paul Williams, because Paul Williams has a small role in it. And it's very similar. You know, guy comes into a strip bar and holds everyone hostage. And that, to me, is what this movie, what Stripteaser could have been if it didn't have the stellar writing, direction, and cast that it had. Headless Body was horrible. And I'm sorry to paint it in such broad terms, but yeah, it was really bad. And it definitely doesn't hold a candle to Stripteaser. Stripteaser is the movie that Headless Body wanted to be.
There is nothing that holds a candle to Stripteaser. It's the 2001 of strip club films. How's that?
With the pole as the monolith, right?
That's right. You should have put that music in there when Maria Ford came out. That'd have been awesome. You know, listen, going back to Rick Dean, I want to talk about him some more because I'm such a huge fan, and I just think that more people need to learn about him and also discover the work he's done. He started out, I mean, basically, he's been in the theater his whole life. He went to all these theater schools. You know, he was like a classically trained actor. And, you know, his mother teaches acting, I think, or she runs some kind of studio. And, you know, he taught acting too as well. Like when he wasn't working in films, he was teaching acting. He was, you know, putting on plays. I think he was directing plays, you know, all under the guise of these movies he was doing, basically. You know, he's also one thing that no one knows probably is that he was actually an artist. He painted, and some of the stuff he did was just amazing. Like, you know, I've never seen quite anything like his. You can't like say it was, you know, this is kind of like cubism, this was kind of like surrealism. Like, I've never quite seen anything like it, and I can't even describe, you know, any kind of style or maybe homage to another kind of you know, school of painting that he was doing. So it's really interesting. Just so everyone knows, actually, Rick passed away, I want to say, like, I think in 2006.
Bada bing, bada boom, dee.
Ta-da!
Little applause, please.
Thank you.
Do you people know that if you're blind, you get to ride the bus for free? I paid $18 for this cane. At the time, I thought it was a bit steep, but I have been riding the shit out of those buses. I bet you I logged about 10 billion miles on them by now, but I strayed from the pan.
So, Mike, one of the things that, you know, you and I have talked about, you know, when we weren't recording the show is, and you talked about it in the interview with Dan, is how much you like the realism in the film, like, you know, the cop with the pimples on his head and stuff. I was wondering if you wanted to talk about that some.
Yeah, I was slightly embarrassed to bring that up to Dan Golden, but that stood out for me, literally as well as figuratively, so much, that pimple on the cop's head. But I like that, and I like that it's very gritty, and you get that. And I love seeing how much Rick Dean is sweating as he's going through and doing some of his monologues, and you just see it kind of, you know, pouring off of his face, which I thought was great. It's not a pretty film. It may have pretty people in it, but it's definitely a very gritty film.
As a director, Dan Golden did an amazing job, because you basically have a movie that's set in one location, so there's not a lot you can do in terms of your background, but he did, you know, do interesting things with the lighting, and he chose some interesting camera angles. And I think, you know, it's funny, there's some camera angles, there's low angle cameras, you know, where the camera's pointing up. It's almost, you know, like the old Batman TV series and some of the camera angles. And I really like that about the film. And that's why I think Dan's such a great director too, is he can take a film that had a budget of $40,000. And the thing is people need to realize they shot this movie in 9 days. They shot it in 9 days or 12 days. I can't remember now, but still, that's a sick amount of time to work on a whole movie. Can you imagine? Like, you must have to put in like 22-hour days just to, you know, finish this movie in, you know, in fucking 10 days or 12 days or whatever. Like, it's crazy. You know, but again, the thing I like about it is I like that about it, that it's a low-budget movie, and it takes place in one location, and it almost feels like a stage play. And so I think that's what makes it shine, essentially, is that you're not distracted. You're so hooked into the story. You know, is this guy going to, you know, is he going to let these people go? Is he going to kill them all? And then, you know, we haven't even talked about the disturbing aspects of the fact that, you know, Rick Dean basically makes this poor stuttering guy who's, you automatically have to assume if he's not handy, mentally handicapped, but he's probably not. And that's a shame on me that I would say that. But I mean, you got to wonder, you know, because he almost comes across that way. And basically, Rick Dean makes Maria Ford's character, Christine, the stripper, literally takes, he makes her take this poor guy into the back room and blow him and have sex with him in order to keep her life. So there's a lot of deviance here in this character. He's a very demented person, and I was actually shocked and stunned, and I'm not a religious man, but I would be if there was a chance that Dan and Dwayne would actually end up finish the script to a part two and possibly get it made. I would become a religious man because I would give up a lot of things in my life to see a sequel to Stripteaser. And there actually was a sequel to Stripteaser that Roger Corman did that's completely unrelated, but I'd like to see their sequel of the story. You know, I think Dan's description in the interview was just amazing, and I'm actually ashamed of myself that I never thought to ask him that, and you were the guy that actually pulled that one out, so thank you.
No problem. I was glad that I asked about the evil twin as well. I just want to bring this up as well, that I never knew what was going to happen in Stripteaser. It kept me guessing the whole time. There were a few times where Rick Dean's character would look at his watch and he would say, you know, we've only got a little bit of time here. So I kept thinking maybe there was some sort of, like, you know, at 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock, something's going to happen. And you've got the cops outside. And, you know, when are they going to show up at the place? Oh, are they going to go over to this guy's place first? And just it really keeps you guessing. The amount of suspense in the film is pitch perfect, and you never had an inkling as to what Rick Dean was really up to, and I thought that was terrific.
Yes. It is. I don't care what Dan says. He says it's a flawed film. Fine. For me, it's like a perfect film in every respect, and I don't care. Like, I will preach about this movie till the day I die. I think every person needs to see this movie. I think if they do, they'll be blown away. I think if we showed it to, you know, fanboys, they'd like it. I think they showed it to movie geeks, they'd like it. I think we showed it to film professors, they would like it. I just can't stress enough. You have to see this movie. You have to go out and buy this movie today on Amazon. It's like $9. You can get it used. You know, let's get this movie bought. So Amazon.com goes to Roger Corman's people and says, we need another 50 copies of Stripteaser. You know, we need to get this movie into the limelight, and we need to get Dan making another film. I think the world really needs it.
50. We need 50,000. You know, if everyone
they probably to this, never made 50,000 copies of Stripteaser.
If everyone listening to this podcast right now goes out, well, maybe we can sell like 5.
Let's issue a challenge. Listen, I know that Dan Golden will do this because I just have a feeling he will. So if everyone buys a copy of Stripteaser, we will give Dan's address out. He can sign them. No, how about every person that buys a copy of Stripteaser, I will donate a quarter to a charity of their choice.
One whole quarter.
Listen, I'm broke.
Ladies and gentlemen, an important announcement from Academy Award-winning actor Mr. George Kennedy.
One very serious point. Lawnmowers do not kill people. People kill people.
Have I told you this is not a toy?
Oh, there was a phone message for you.
Oh, wow. From Norman?
Oh, wow. He didn't say.
Oh, come on, Mom. What did he say?
Well, at first he goes, your daughter's gonna die tonight.
Police business? Might have a few words with you.
I'll never forget the first time I saw your father.
If I'm rambling on too much, just let me know.
Not at all.
What?
Wacko, wacko.
At last, a motion picture made by, for, and about people just like you and me.
We've come to the end of another episode of The Projection Booth. We'd like to thank you for listening and hope that everyone out there enjoyed the show. Next week, we'll be covering the 1982 Graydon Clark screwball horror movie spoof, Wacko, starring Andrew Dice Clay and George Kennedy. And we'll also be speaking to Graydon Clark. We interviewed him a few weeks back at the Indianapolis Horror Hound Convention.
Right. And it's going to be great to talk about Wacko. It's a ton of fun, and Dice Clay is the man.
You know he is.
Let me just add one final thought about this before we go, because I really love this movie to death, and I really want everyone to see it. It's an amazing film, and I guarantee you that if you buy this movie, you will be blown the fuck away by it. It is one of a kind. You'll never see anything like it again, and you will see Rick Dean's performance, and you'll pass out, and your head will explode, because it's one of the greatest performances ever given on film. It's amazing, and this is a movie that virtually no one has seen, so you'll be blown away by it again. I've said that 16 times now, and I'll say it 4 more times just so we have a 20. You seriously can pick it up on Amazon for $10. Make sure you buy the white cover version. There's a black cover as well. I'm not sure if the black covers are put on DVD. I know there's a VHS of the black cover. Supposedly, one is rated, but the other one is unrated, I guess. That's the word. But in my opinion, I've seen both, and there is no difference between the two. So I think it was just a Corman marketing gimmick. I'm pushing the hell out of this film. I'm working on a book right now, and there will be entire chapters dedicated to Rick Dean, Maria Ford, Dan Golden, and this film. Mike, do you have a final thought on the film?
My head exploded.
You watch the movie and your eyeballs just crushed and leaked.
Final thoughts on the I do have a comment on the film.
All right.
I don't have a final thought on the film, but I just want to say, Justin, thank you very much for showing me Stripteaser. I'm a better man for having seen it.
And Rich Osman thanks you for watching it as well, finally. Because you know he's sitting there, like, twiddling his thumbs, being like, I told that asshole to watch that 16 years ago when it came out in 1996 or whatever it was. Why is this asshole telling him to watch it? And he does. If I would have known that, I would have started a podcast 16 years ago, and we could have watched it then. You know, we're going to play you out with a song by Billy Barnett. Billy was in the Dan Golden film Saturday Night Special, and Mike and I are going to head down to our local strip club as blind guys.
I rode the shit out of that bus.
Sugar babe, honey, you're the one. Sugar babe, you got me all undone. Sugar babe, can't get you off my mind. Think about you all the time. Sugar babe, oh, I feel so weak. Sugar babe, I can hardly speak. Sugar babe, just one touch makes me shiver.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, baby. You are so hot. Well, I don't know about anybody else, but I certainly got a hard on.